Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
And we are back. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'm pumped to be here today. More news, more events. Our resident millennial, Darren, is at the helm. Always makes me feel good. And thank you for joining us for the most scintillating hour of finance radio. And as always, tongue in cheek. But first of all, before we get going, I want to thank everybody once again to come into the seminar, the class that we did a couple weeks back. Gotten a chance to meet so many of you. And, you know, this is one of the coolest parts of the job that I do. Getting to meet you guys, and honestly, it's a little bit of, pardon the corny comparison here, but it's a little bit chicken soup for the soul. I think there's a lot of us out there that are looking at things differently and probably feel isolated at some points, probably feel like the whole world is going mad around us. And it's so great to meet so many of you guys. And we're going to have more events coming up. So if you missed it, we're kind of refocusing on that. We're going to do road shows, kind of traveling around the South Sound area and the North Sound and getting to different locations, because I know some of you live too far out there. But basically, just so you know, these quote-unquote seminars, they're essentially a radio show, except we get to talk. Shoot, we were there for almost 2 hours after the end of the class talking to listeners that had come in. And, you know, you hear me every week doing this. I do it because I enjoy it. I do it because I'm endlessly fascinated by the topic of, you know, global economics and investing and all those things. And so if you want to go, there's not a sales pitch. There's no twisting of arms. It's more of a meeting of like minds. We walk you through our process. But like I said, we spent more time talking and doing Q&A and discussing different aspects of retirement and the global economic system and the global financial system than we did talking about, you know, how to roll over your 403B, which we can obviously help you with. I'm just saying that it's not all a sales pitch. It's not all a marketing thing. Anyway, so just thank you so much. And keep an eye out. Well, obviously, we'll give you a warning here on the show for those dates coming up in 2020. Still sounds weird to say that. Darren, does it seem weird to you to say 2020? I mean, you are a millennial. Give us an insight to that. It's got to even be a little bit jarring for you, huh?
And I turn 30 next month, so it will be
30 and 20.
So yeah, so say it that way. That's
so
weird.
So here's the question I've got. Now this is interesting. See, this is the bridge of philosophy and finance here, part of the most scintillating hour of radio, of course. But when you hit 30 to 35 years old and you're married and you're a homeowner, are you really a millennial?
Yeah, I think I am, because millennials are older than people think now, and we're no longer the college kid.
Right, right.
There's a whole new generation that is that now.
Well, and you're a banner waver. You're a responsible, married, homeowning. You're defying the critics. You're defying the percentages.
Right, and I think it's sort of a misconception, because a lot of us in my age group want to be, and maybe are doing everything they can to be, but just aren't able to due to one reason or another. And now we're getting to the age where we have to start taking care of our parents too.
Oh, I see that all the time. No, I think it's fascinating, because we joke around with you a lot. We give the millennials a bad time, but
for the most part, it's deserved.
Well, Yeah, you're not going to. But, you know, this is also the way of the world, right? Every generation that comes along is going to be they're all screwed up. I think there's a lot of promise there. There's also a lot of pent up capabilities. And the other thing, too, is that the system or the environment has not lended itself very well for what we call household formation. You know, think of that. Think of the price that these kids have got to pay for a home nowadays. It's insane. There's so many parts of the world where they can't live. They just can't afford it. It's just not within their reach. But anyway, so getting on to the show, obviously going to hit the market update. You know, my odds based on what is currently going on, I would expect the year to come to probably a triumphant end. I wouldn't be surprised to see us rally hard here into the end. That's what indexes are saying. You know, we have firmly broken out through all-time highs. I will say volume remains very weak and somewhat non-existent, but it's there. We see upward price moment, right? Things are still rocking. We see a bid coming back into the tech stocks that have gotten slammed. Valuations continue to just get more and more astronomical while earnings estimates continue to decline. And then sadly, I am watching, and I've been talking about this now for a year and a half, I am watching the excitement in retail investors continue to climb. I am seeing some of the most insane allocations I've seen in my entire career. People running around like they're bulletproof. Guys, just be careful out there. And if you don't have a risk management strategy and you're sitting in the typical mutual fund and bond portfolio, call us. There's a better way to do it. We can pay less in fees. We can have more upside potential in the portfolio. But most important, we can be significantly more guarded against the downside. So anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. We'll continue on with the market update here. What else we seeing? Seeing a bit of a pop here in oil. Still not a significant breakout. We're bumping up against 60. Dollar is still bouncing around in that 97 to 98 rate or range on the DXY. Not a lot of movement there. What I think we're seeing here, guys, is once again, we've seen total detachment from the underlying economy and market prices. I don't think that's new. It just keeps getting to get more and more exacerbated. The interesting part about this, though, is that I don't think we've seen a market surge like this. We've seen some bad backdrops, but we haven't seen a market surge like this with this backdrop, where the data continues to get more depressed. People go, oh, well, look at this. Everybody points out the one or two good things, right? And again, I've said that a year and a half now, right? It's not red lights. There's a couple, but there's flashing yellows. My concern is that markets and asset prices are acting like it's not. Everybody's today talking about a blowout jobs report. Guys, the one thing you got to keep, and again, this isn't me dogging the country or dogging the economy or dogging the press, none of that. That has nothing to do with this, right? Leave your political ideals at the door when we discuss finance or you'll get wrecked. That I can promise you that. But when we talk about a blowout jobs number, remember, in the world of economics, and this is a fact, there is no more of a lagging indicator than jobs. Typically, jobs will not show recessionary-like characteristics until 8 months to 10 months after after things have peaked. It is the last thing to react. And why is that? Because we as human beings think linearly. We think every little bump in the road is just a slowdown. We're going to be back on track. We don't stop hiring and we don't start firing until we are forced to. So jobs, look, nobody disagrees with this. Again, I studied economics in college. Jobs are the most, unemployment numbers and jobs and unemployment rates are the most lagging indicator in all of economics. Now, guys, the other side of it is this, right? Nobody's got a crystal ball, including me. We say it all the time. The other side of it is this. I think it is really interesting. Now, I've sat there for three years now talking about how this market is completely driven by central banks. And it's a function, right? It's why we call capital liquidity. If you pump that liquidity into the system, it has to go somewhere. I think it is really interesting that within about 10 months of ending QE, the market stalled out and we went sideways for nearly 2 years. This September, October, the Fed launched repo, their standing repo facility. They started buying bonds again. The Fed's balance sheet is back over $4 trillion. What's happened to the market? We've hit new all-time highs. Okay, I know for a fact there are some of you sitting back there, oh, well, it's, you know, it's nonsense. It's just pull up a chart. Pull up a chart of the Fed's balance sheet overlaid over the S&P 500, and you'll see what I'm talking about. It stands out like a sore thumb. Blind man could see it in a minute. It's just a function of pumping money. Now, and that's the one caveat, guys. That's the one reason. Our valuation's insane. Yes, I don't care what anybody says. If you take debt into consideration, you start valuing U.S. stocks, it's insanity. People go, well, look at all the record of cash. Yeah, well, the vast majority of that cash, I want to say 80 to 85% of it is on the balance sheets of less than 10 companies. Okay, so we're just going to keep popping these narrative bubbles and hit you with the truth. It's a Fed-driven market. And we cannot get idealistic about that because the one caveat we don't know is how long can they keep doing it? I don't know. I don't see an end in sight at this point. I can run some scenarios at you. You know, the dollar starts declining in value. You know, these global political shocks of some kind. I can see some things that would do it, but they're not there yet. And you know, I've talked to so many of you about it over the last 2 weeks. Look, is everything nuts? Yeah, it's insane. Valuations are insane. Right? Debt loads are insane. It's nuts. But they can keep it up a lot longer than anybody thinks. And that's why, guys, we keep going back to our risk management model, not because we think we're smarter than everybody else, not because we think that we've figured out nobody's got the gold standard. Okay, but when you see a market that is being driven by non-natural forces, and if you've got open eyes and you're willing to look at things differently, you see very shortly, very quickly, you're going to see how much influence central bank activity has had in these markets. It's undeniable. And so you have to build a portfolio that isn't. That's the other thing. I see so many different mutual fund strategies, and I'm not going to get into them because a lot of them I don't think are bad. You know, the lower cost mutual funds, of course. In general, I'm horrifically against them because, as you guys all know, I've ranted several times. You can get the same bloody performance in an ETF at a fraction of the cost. A fraction. And guys, a 0.8 or a 1% decrease in your fees over a 20-year period of time makes a mountain of a difference. Quit whistling past the graveyard. If you're sitting on a 50-50 stock bond portfolio because you're concerned, which is probably one of the reasons you listen to this show, you know, or you're trying to be conservative and you've got mutual funds in there, let me just tell you something. You have robbed just the excess fees alone in that portfolio have robbed you of somewhere between 20 to 25% of the gains you should have had over the last 10 years. That's how big of a difference it makes. And remember, no, you're not taking any more risk. Right? It's the same underlying investment. You're just doing it in an incredibly inefficient way. And it's not just inefficient in terms of cost, it's inefficient in terms of taxes. You should see the look on people's faces when they buy a mutual fund and a couple of years later the thing's lost money, they go to sell it and they take a capital gain. Most advisors don't even know about that. But there's no upside. The world has changed, guys. It's no longer flat, right? There's a different way to do it. And fees have to be a focus. But again, getting back into the risk management strategy, that's why you gotta have a portfolio that will stand up in the nastiest of storms, but will actually make really good gains if the Fed just keeps pumping this up. Because I'll tell you, there is no natural breaking point. We're too far in the game now. They will pump until it breaks, period. And they'll use all kinds of justification, the pacification of civil unrest, geopolitical tension, they'll use anything, right, to maintain the status quo. And I'm not being conspiratorial, but just think of the language, right? The Fed, the market drops 20% at the end of last year. The Fed comes out, oh, okay, don't believe us. We're not going to raise rates anymore. Why? Because markets dropped 20%. And so many of you go, oh, well, thank God they did it. No. Not thank God they did it. You don't have free markets. They're being manipulated and they're being controlled. And the reason that scares me is not because I'm an idealist, but the reason it scares me is because the dislocation between reality and asset prices will just continue to grow. So when it finally does break, it's going to be biblical. And again, I'm not, guys, this might take 20 years, but it could happen within 6 months. And you need to confront the reality of what you're facing. You got to say, I know it's not fun. I was telling a client, I said, look, I don't like this. You know how much easier my job would be if I really believed that, well, we'll just do some stocks and bonds and we're going to make our rebalances. We're going to go right along. Everything's healthy. Believe in the strength of the American economy. You know, look, the other thing is that we're not telling you the typical stuff you hear on the radio or the typical stuff you hear at seminars. Which means what? It means that we're swimming upstream. If our goal was just to capture clients, this wouldn't be the song I'm singing. What are we trying to do? We're trying to warn you. And more importantly, I think this is the biggest thing. We're not asking you to buy into a cult of personality or a cult of how we do it. We're the only guys that have it figured out. What I'm telling you is we don't. It's the other guys that are telling you how it's going to work. It's the other guys sitting there ignoring the last 10 to 15, 20 years of market returns and telling you to base your entire retirement, your life savings on the averages playing out, even though that's the exact opposite of what's happened. We're building the portfolio in such a way that we go, hey, your retirement has to work regardless of what happens. It doesn't do me any good to look at you when you're down 70% in the next economic catastrophe and tell you, well, you know, the averages. Well, throw the averages out. Nothing is average about what we're currently doing. And, you know, if you're a rational adult, you should understand that. And I don't mean to insult anybody. But if you're a rational adult, you should have the understanding of, hey, you know, at some point, outputs equal inputs. And the inputs are the virtual inverse. It's a bizarro world of what they were in the previous 80 years. So what in the world are we expecting these averages to play out? Now, here's the thing. That doesn't necessarily mean everything's going to collapse. You could see asset prices soar from here. But it's not going to have anything to do with the underlying strength of the American economy. I can tell you that. It have to do with inflation, increased money printing, and all these other different things. So what all of you sitting there in the traditional stock bond portfolio, mutual fund, not only are you paying way too much and paying an advisory fee that is doing nothing other than just collecting rent on your assets, because that's what they're doing. And again, it's not for nefarious reasons. It's just the model's broken. Like so many other models in society today, the model is broken. But if you really think about it, that's a binary outcome. That is a binary portfolio. It will work if the status quo is continued, even though we see it fraying at every level. Even though we've seen bonds working in lockstep with stocks as opposed to being inversely correlated for the last 10 years, that's the same message we keep preaching, right? It defies logic. But that's what's going on. And it's a binary outcome. It is, even though, like I said, record low interest rates, all these things that are historical anomalies, we've still using the exact same portfolio. And what we tell clients is, look, I don't know what's going to happen, but we're going to position your assets in such a way that you're going to be fine regardless. If things keep going up and I'm wrong and debt doesn't matter and there is no financial gravity, great. Everything you own is going to go up. Your portfolio with us is going to blow the doors off of the traditional stock bond portfolio because of a reduction of fees, because it's more efficient, all these other things. But if it doesn't, if that's not the scenario that plays out and it's not the Buzz Lightyear market, like I've said so many times, to infinity and beyond, and a reckoning is due, which I strongly believe, the only thing is that reckoning may be in rapid inflation. It may be a deflationary collapse. A lot of different things. And I'm not talking, when I say collapse, I don't mean like zombie apocalypse collapse. I just mean, you know, depressionary type event. The difference with the way that we're setting it up is you're going to do better than where you're currently positioned, regardless of which side of it plays out. And who doesn't want that? Do we bring in a lot of new clients? Yes. I'm shocked by the ones we don't. And it's just in the numbers. People that came to the seminar, they saw it for themselves. Just show you the performance. So if you're listening to this And maybe you wanted to come to the seminar. Maybe you want, you know, I would just tell you, hey, educate yourselves. Right? What you're doing hasn't worked over the last 20 years. Accept that and ask yourself why. And then listen to another opinion. And you can get that opinion by calling us at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. You can get our free booklet, Talks Common Sense Investing. You can listen to the podcast, which you can access through iTunes or Stitcher or whatever the case may be. But talk to us. It's just not a sales trick. We're not going to twist your arm and try to. We don't need to. It's not the way we do business. We just sit down and say, look, here's where you're currently at. We run it, your current portfolio through our risk assessment software. It tells you all the hidden fees, tells you the risk, tells you the efficiency of the portfolio, how the portfolio performed during the financial crisis, how it performed over the last 10 years. We got all these different aspects. So at the very least, you're going to know exactly what you've got, the strengths and weaknesses. Now, what's pretty compelling is when we show you our alternative. And it's not us trying to pitch it. We said, hey, we got here because we said, what works better? How can we improve this? So just educate yourselves. I know so many of you are getting excited watching the market go, guys, it's tough. It's tough preaching that message at the top of markets. Nobody wants to hear it. But like I said, we're not telling you to put it under a mattress. If things keep going up, you're going to do better. That's the whole point. The difference is when the music stops, you're going to have a chair. So again, if that interests you, which it should, give us a call, 866-779-RISK and 866-779-RISK. Now, we got to end the show here. Well, not end the show. I think it's about to get more interesting. Anyway, we've got our special guest coming up today, Michael Krieger of LibertyBlitzkrieg.com. We're going to talk about gold. We're going to talk about markets. We're going to also talk about Bitcoin. He's a Bitcoin connoisseur, if you will. And I think this is very important because a lot of people who listen to this show are of like minds. We see things very similarly. I personally don't own any Bitcoin. I've had a lot of reservations about it, but there is a bright side to it. Don't just dismiss it because it's something that is not at me for a long time. There are incredible things about it that have always been attractive to me. And we want to have Mike on to really illuminate that and really give you a look at what it is and help you better understand it. And help you better understand the potentials and the potential pitfalls. But anyway, we've got him coming up next, so we got to cut things off here. But again, and it's a phenomenal. Oh, and then by the way, also, we've got to cut that interview off short because we've only got an hour, as always. But you can go to the podcast. You can catch the remainder of the episode, which I would strongly suggest you do. Even if you think Bitcoin's a bubble, it's worthless, all that other kind of stuff. I get it, guys. I don't own any. I haven't bought any for clients. I get it. But open your ears and just be open-minded about it. I just challenge you to listen to it because Mike is a very accomplished, very smart guy. And I think he brings up a lot of great points. So I'm really excited to bring this interview to you. Be open-minded. Listen to the remainder of it on the podcast. Anyway, we got to get running and get this interview headed your way. But as always, like I said, if you want to explore a better way, call us, 866-779-RISK. You can meet with me. If you don't want to call us, you can email in via the website. And we're just going to show you how we do things. We're going to run the analysis on your portfolio. We're going to leave you with the data. If you decide to become a client, great. If not, at least you're smarter. At least you understand what else is out there. At least you see how much less risk, how much less fees are possible, and how much greater upside you can get. Educate yourself. Take that opportunity. Anyway, without further ado, we want to get to the interview. And we'll, like I said, we got to cut it off short, but stick with us. And thank you so much for joining. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
What does outside-the-box investing really look like? Schedule your free risk review with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management, and see a side-by-side comparison of your current portfolio versus one Zach would recommend. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. And Zach, as we close out the year and look ahead to a crazy election year in 2020, what's the number one thing investors need to be aware of?
Dory, I'll tell you the same thing I told you when you and Suzanne became clients. Risk management. We're looking at 10 to 15 new prospective client portfolios every week. And I see two things. A, people are being far too cautious, or B, people aren't being nearly cautious enough. And remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We can take less risk, pay far less in fees, and increase our upside potential. And our free booklet, Common Sense Investing, will show you exactly how we do that.
Call Zach right now to get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK or knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm's licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor. One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high costs of an extended healthcare situation. Many people assume they have enough money saved only to watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Do not make that mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you will not become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn about all the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay you back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott, who's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. Brian has a long-term care planning class coming up December 14th. Seating will be limited for this final class of the year, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. It's a free class. You'll get a copy of Brian's book, too, 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. And it's been a while, been a little bit, but we've got an interview, and it's one that I'm really pumped and excited to bring to you guys today. It's a guy that I have been reading for quite a while. Interesting to finally get a chance to talk to him. And one of those interviews where you just it kind of catches you off guard because you go, you know, I never really thought I'd be having a conversation with this guy. But then reading his stuff was part of my journey, part of me getting to where I am. And he was a source of information for me and a source of confirmation for what I was seeing. And he's been a prominent voice in financial media for quite a while. I'll say financial alternative media. But anyway, without further ado, that special guest with us today is Mike Krieger of LibertyBlitzkrieg.com. It's been a great source of information for me. So first of all, I would recommend that you check out his website, LibertyBlitzkrieg.com, and then on Twitter at Liberty Blitz. So Mike, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to the show.
Oh, hey, Zach. It's great to be on your show. I don't go on, you know, financially focused stuff as much anymore because it's not, you know, it doesn't consume my life like it used to. So it'll be fun, you know, to talk to a different audience or a more financially focused audience. So thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. And you know, I'm assuming you would agree. I think to be truly financially focused, I see you as being truly financially focused. It may not jive with CNBC's definition of financially focused, but it sure jives with mine. And first and foremost, you're not just a guy howling on the internet. I want the readers to understand your background. You went to Duke, studied economics. You got hired by Lehman Brothers as a oil and gas analyst. Then you went to Sanford C. Bernstein on Wall Street, a prominent and respected Wall Street firm. You started writing there, and you had a heck of a career going on in Wall Street. And then, surprising, you know, to so many of the people out there chasing the carrot, then you decided to leave. So let's start there, Mike. I don't have time, but there's so much good stuff that you've done on the internet. People can find the whole story, but give us an abridged rundown of where you're at today and how you got there and why you'd walk away from a really promising career on Wall Street that had a ton of momentum.
That's all correct, and it's a strange journey. I think, you know, 99.9% of people in my shoes would definitely not have left, and probably if I hadn't left, life would have been easier, but not as interesting, and I would certainly be a lot less happy, I believe, and content, you know, versus where I am. But it was a crazy choice. But to give you from a conventional standpoint, that is. But to give you a little background, yeah, so I'm a New York City kid originally. That's where I grew up, in the heart of Manhattan. You know, went to Duke, as you said. I really didn't have much of a, let's say, I wasn't that thoughtful at the time. You know, and I guess a lot of 18, 19 year olds aren't. But I, you know, about the world and what I wanted and meaning and purpose and all that. It just wanted to sort of enjoy life and, you know, whatever. And so I sort of stumbled my way into Wall Street. I did like markets. I always had that sort of, the way my mind works is a macro, is from just works macro, always has, big picture. But I also really love the idea that every day you wake up and there's a million things to look at and a million new sources of information to consume and then apply that in a sort of a very, you know, P&L way to in real life, which the markets allowed. So I was always fascinated by it, but I wasn't one of these guys, and there were a lot of them at Duke that you know, spent 4 years saying, I'm going to go to Wall Street. You know, I'm going to spend these 4 years trying to get to Wall Street. I didn't do that, you know, but I did major in economics. And then, you know, when I went, it was going into Wall Street, it was the biggest class ever, pretty much. You know, it was 2000. I literally started in July of 2000. So they hired a lot of people, which is probably how I snuck in there in the first place. But anyway, I ended up at Lehman Brothers, as you said, equity research. I did 5 years, you know, in the models. You know, I was in a cubicle, basically dug into a model for, you know, 12, 13 hours a day. And I did that for 5 years, at which point I had enough of that and moved on to Sanford C. Bernstein, as you said, which is a, you know, very much a research-driven firm. That's what they do. They just do really deep dives on industries and companies. And there I was a commodities desk analyst. I really sat on the trading desk analyzing the whole space and helping to sell the research analysts' material as well. And it was there that towards the end, I mean, as you say, you know, my career, when I left Bernstein, when I resigned, I was at the top of my game. I mean, I was making a ton of money for, you know, someone that age, 30, 31 years old. And, you know, I had a huge bright future ahead of me in a conventional sense. But when the financial crisis hit and I saw the response to it, right, and I saw that all of the nation's resources were being geared to saving people like me, who were the last people that needed to be saved, in a very crony and dishonest way, it just, some sort of light bulb went off in my head. And, you know, my ego, you know, this was fortunate for me. My ego was sort of able to die a little bit. You know, I had a huge ego, obviously, at that point, right? Like, you're young, you're in New York, you think you're amazing, right? Because you're making a lot of money,
right,
and you're successful, and you think it's because you're so amazing. But what I realized with the bailouts was that the only reason I'm making money like this, and sure, I was good at my job, but the big picture reason was because the system is set up to enrich people doing that sort of a job. And at that point, it became a lot less interesting. And I sort of, you know, I felt like I didn't have anything else to prove anymore. And I felt dirty, you know, in the industry. And so I left, you know, I quit as soon as I got my bonus in January of 2010, literally the day it hit my bank account, I quit. And it was a great moment, but, you know, it's been an interesting journey since, you know, 10 years. This January will be 10 years since I left. So, you know, that's the background on Wall Street.
Yeah, no, in reading, you know, we were talking off air, and I mean it earnestly and honestly. You know, we've had several guys on the show that have kind of that have been in the same, a similar place for me, meaning that you were one of the sources that I was reading on my own journey around that exact same time frame. Because I think that there's some of us, and I think you'd agree, it feels incredibly lonely, and I'm honestly shocked that more people haven't, you know, woken up and come more this way and opened their eyes and seen, you know, behind the curtain and seen really what's going on. But we were talking off air about how disillusioning, or you know, how it was just there was so much disillusion and I don't know, I wouldn't call it depression, but just, you know, shaking your head going, wait a second, this isn't what I thought it was. And realizing what's really pulling the levers and what really matters. And that in a lot of ways, this is no longer a free market. In a lot of ways, they've cracked down on freedom in general. So reading your stuff was part of my journey and part of my waking up and realizing that, you know, there is no there. That this is a charade. It's a shell of what it used to be. And so first of all, I applaud you for what you're doing and then speaking out and, you know, trying to educate people, which is something we do on this radio show, or we attempt to do. Obviously I manage money. I run an RIA. And so, we talk a lot of finance, but trying to give our clients that background of really what's happening in the world. And so, first and foremost, I just wanted to say thank you, because you've been one of those voices that's really helped clarify and bring, you know, focus to the things that were bothering me and pointing things out. And that's why I'd encourage everybody to go to your website, and get into your reading. So now fast forward, we moved to Colorado. You've had enough of the rat race. You've had enough of being part of the slum, the financial slum, as I refer to it. And you've essentially retired from markets and you manage your own money now. I know that you're not horrifically involved in stock markets anymore, but you became very focused on gold and then Bitcoin. I'm assuming that's the proper order from reading your stuff. But tell us how that transition happened, because, again, it intrigues me because, I got very into gold as well right around the same time. Kind of tell me how you came to that realization and how that move started happening for you.
Okay. Yeah, so a few things. I mean, first, I just want to touch upon what you mentioned about your own journey, because every single person, and I know quite a few, right? I am a lot, actually, that has gone through something similar. And for most of us, you know, around the similar age, it's going to be the financial crisis that right. Basically was when you first peered behind the curtain and said, "Oh boy," you know. And so when you peer behind that, you either dig deeper and accept it and then go into a period of depression, or you just sort of say, "Oh, I don't want to look at that," and you forget about it, which right. A lot of people do as well. But, you know, for people like me and you who are just very curious, I'm assuming, you can't look the other way once you've seen it. You know, you've seen it. You can't forget it. And so there was for me a period of loneliness and depression, right, where I felt nobody understood me really, right? Very few people were writing about what I thought. The people that were tending to write about what I thought were big into gold, right? I think that's one of the things that happens. Yeah. The other is, of course, if you think at that time that let's put it this way. Let's rewind for a second. I mean, if you've been living up to 2008, if you'd been living on Earth for, let's say, 30 years or so and paid some attention to markets or worked in markets, you understood that, of course, there's the Fed. Of course, there's influences that manipulate markets. But there was always a bit of freedom to them, right? There was always a bit of, like, chaos and stuff over the years. And so my assumption around 2008 and 2009 was that there would be at least some cleansing allowed, or at least, if not allowed, forced upon the market by economic nature. I was wrong about that, right, in the short term.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why I was wrong. The reason I was wrong is because I did not fully understand the country we live in, right, as you said. I didn't understand that we don't have a democracy, we don't have a republic, we don't have a constitution anymore. I was naive in that sense. A lot of people knew that, but I did not, right? I was too busy making money on Wall Street to actually thoughtfully think about what had happened in the prior 8 years of the 21st century, post 9/11, when we lost so much freedom in a lot of ways. And so the more I started digging, the more I started realizing, well, okay, none of this is like I thought it was. You know, we really do live in very much what Sheldon Wolin calls an inverted totalitarianism.
Yep.
We have a totalitarian structure, an oligarchy, a feudalistic structure in a lot of ways. It's very much hidden. And those that, you know, sort of benefit from it certainly don't question it. And we continue to live in that. But the point being is, you know, this was the right way to think about 2008, 2009 at the time. You know, the U.S. government, right, the state, went to Iraq because they wanted to go to Iraq. They lied about it, right? Hundreds of thousands of people dead. country is destroyed, and Iraq's just one example, right? So if the state is willing to do that, if the state is willing to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions across all of these wars, $6.4 trillion has been spent on the war on terror since 2001, if they're willing to do that, why wouldn't they be willing to do anything to markets? And that is what I did not appreciate at the time. And that's exactly what the last 10 years have shown me, is that the power structure in this country, right, is so invested in empire and financialization, that they view it as a war, right? So I think the Fed and the government, across administrations, views propping up assets, right, the asset bubble that we have, the biggest asset bubble in world history, especially with debt, they see it as a war. You know, they literally see it as a national security thing. And so if I had realized that the empire would throw every single thing it had, every lie, every cheat, every corruption at propping up assets, I probably would have seen things differently. But I didn't have that view of the country at that point. I did not have the accurate assessment of what we were really dealing with. And quite frankly, now I think it's pretty clear 10 years later, that is what we're dealing with.
Oh, yeah. No, 100%. I've described it before. It's sort of the merger of philosophy and finance, because you really we think that we're dealing with a spreadsheet world and a data driven world, you know, in terms of, you know, input this and this is the profit margin and this is what runs things. And then you realize, well, it plays a role, but it's a side role. It really is a side role. This is about power. This is about the creation of money. This is about positioning you and your corporation as close as you can to that spigot, to that power, whether it's, you know, the senator or the Federal Reserve or what, you know, whatever it is. Maybe it's hiring a former Federal Reserve chairman to be on your board. It's the positioning of the power and the proximity to that spigot that has trumped everything. And right down to, like you said, you know, controlling markets and making the machine keep going. And you know, this whole idea that making markets rise, right, and suppressing volatility is good for, and it's good for the average investor. And he goes, oh, thank God the Federal Reserve jumped in. And it just infuriates me, because I sit there and I go, look, I understand nobody wants to look at their account and see that they lost money, but volatility is your friend. Market crashes are what cleans out the muck. It's what pushes assets into the hands of other people, right? It even though you don't think it, it's the, if we suppress volatility, there is no turnover in terms of who has the assets, who has the money, and who has the power. And it's you know, that's this hijacking of public markets. And it's infuriating to me. And it's been going on for some time. And I think you've pointed that out, you know, that out so well. This is not new. But to me, I want to get into so many other topics, but I want to get your thoughts on this. I came to a realization when I was watching Noam Chomsky's Requiem for an American Dream, which, again, is strange. Me and Noam Chomsky are strange bedfellows. I grew up very much on the capitalist conservative side of things. In most ways, I still am, you know, much more on that side of things and that side of thinking. Although I have unidentified that with a, you know, I don't think of myself as being Republican, right? I'm more libertarian. But I point back to, and I feel like so many people dance around this, but they don't get to the issue. To me, everything points back, and there's other factors, but the biggest thing that I see is everything points back to 1971. Everything points to when we went off the gold standard, government no longer had a report card. There was no way to hold them accountable. What are your thoughts on that, and do you see the similar thing? And we kind of walk me through your take on that.
Okay, sure. So first of all, yeah, like as far as Chomsky, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, because, again, you know, people, this is what keeps people divided and unthinking. You know, so someone that, let's say, considers themselves a capitalist or a libertarian, whatever, you know, and they hear Chomsky or like read this by Chomsky, they'll say, oh, no, that guy's, you know, this crazy leftist. I'm not reading it.
Right.
And that's just so intellectually, you're being an intellectual midget, because whether you concur with Chomsky's solutions or what he thinks needs to be done, the man is a brilliant describer of what we're in, you know, what we're living in. I mean, I've been listening. Sometimes on YouTube, I'll listen to stuff from this guy like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I'm just like, man, people knew, you know, people knew a lot of this stuff, you know. It's been going on for a while. The national security state has been going on for a while. So I think you're asking about the gold standard. So I really think we need to see this whole thing from a very big picture standpoint. And really, when the modern American empire is what we're dealing with, right?
Right.
And that empire flexes its muscles over the decades in different ways. Now, I would say the beginning of the end for the republic, right, or any semblance of self-government at all, happened immediately after World War II, with the creation of the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. Once that happened, you really started, you got immediately what Eisenhower warned of, the military-industrial complex. And that was the beginning of the end. And so at that point, you know, American empire was exercised through strength, through actual strength, right? I mean, there was a gold standard. You know, the U.S. had almost the whole world's manufacturing base. It was the only place that wasn't bombed to smithereens. So the empire was there, right? It was born in earnest after World War II, but it really exercised power in a more conventional way. 1971 is where the U.S. empire figured out a way to exercise power without, in a non-traditional sense. In other words, via the fiat dollar. And that's what we've been living through ever since. So by not having to exercise empire through traditional means, right, actual wealth, actual, let's say, power, the dollar allowed financialization and banking to dominate the world. And it's a much lazier way of doing it, but it's a cheaper way, and it's a very, very, what I like to say is the fiat U.S. dollar as reserve currency is the most powerful geopolitical weapon that's ever existed.
Yep.
And it continues to exist right to this day, but what that's also meant is a hollowing out of the rest of American society. Right. We've seen rapid growth in debt. We've seen rapid growth in financial oligarch power, financial services power. And we see now the ability to ruin countries just by using a dollar that's backed by nothing. Right. So that's where we're at right now. Right. I mean, it's been 50 years almost since the financial empire, right? The financialized empire really took hold. And, you know, my view is that by 2025, that financial empire will be in clear decline. But that's how I see it. So, yes, 71 was really important. But let's not think that, you know, the U.S. had already died in a lot of ways, right? The constitutional United States had already died in a lot of ways right after World War II.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It was interesting to me. I totally agree with that timeline, and I think if you're a student of history, it's really hard to see it any other way. Obviously, I would entertain other ideas and listen to people with other opinions. But one of the things that frustrates me is that even listening to a guy like Chomsky, like I said, strange bedfellow, but if you listen to that, if you watch that documentary, he dances all around it, and he never addresses it. He points to all these things around 1971 and late 60s, even talks about post-World War II. But I love the way you set that up. The ball was already in motion, right? It was beginning to roll. And I feel like, or the way that I view it is 71 was the gloves coming off. It was, you know, here we are in all of our grand splendor, and we're not even going to fake it anymore. We're going to tell you there's nothing backing it. And the beautiful thing about that is it removes the control. It removes the constraints. I've tried to explain it to people. Look, if you still had a gold standard, do you think we would have fought as many wars? You know, no, there's no, we wouldn't have been able to afford it, right? There would have been constraints. Think how many lives have been lost. Due to just go, like you said, the ball was in motion, but just going off the gold standard. Anyway, it's perplexing to me. Now I want to get to your thoughts on gold and how you got there, because obviously all of this points to you know, the need or obviously in our opinion, the need for some type of, you know, not an asset that can't be controlled by government, an asset that holds people accountable. How did that exploration or that move into gold happen with you?
Yes. Okay. So a few things, and I'm going to put Bitcoin in here too, because I'm as big of a proponent of Bitcoin, probably even more so than gold for a variety of reasons we can get into if you'd like at this point. But I am, you know, if people ask me, what should they be owning? You know, I would say, you know, you should have some USD because you need to serve, you need to live, and assets like Bitcoin and gold can be volatile. But other than that, you know, I have some Bitcoin, some gold, and some U.S. dollars. I mean, that's how I am, right?
Yeah.
But look, with gold, the reason I first got into it, right, and explored it is because, you know, it's pretty simple. You know, when you look at the debt, and you look at how this thing can play out over you know, any sort of long period of time, it becomes very clear that, you know, what I like to say recently is populism is inflationary. We're going to the idea. Look, who has a lot of the debt? Millennials, right?
Yep.
Who's now the largest generation in America? Millennials. How are they going to vote? Right? I mean, you're already starting to see it with stuff like MMT becoming more popular and Green New Deal and all this stuff. I mean, there's no way, in my view, that this doesn't get resolved via just some sort of debt jubilee. And in that kind of an environment, you know, gold is an asset you want to hold. There's no, if you have physical gold, obviously there's no counterparty risk, which is very important, you know, in today's financial world. And it's sort of just the reset asset. And don't forget, I mean, you know, I got quiet on gold for a while after, you know, I realized, you know, sort of like what we discussed before, when I realized that the entire American empire was 100% dedicated to keeping a financial bubble alive, that's when I realized, okay, well, we need to take a step back here. You know, they've won for now, right?
Yes.
The cycle. And that was, let's say, 2011 to 2011, October 2011, September was the high in gold. And then I started getting more bullish publicly last September-ish, because, you know, well, it was 7 years, right? It was a nice cycle for me. But also I started looking geopolitically, things changing. And as China and the U.S. tensions continue to increase, you know, central banks and governments are going to play in gold. I mean, that's really where they are. When, you know, a lot of the gold bug rhetoric over the last, let's say, post-financial crisis, was that everyone was going to buy physical gold, and, you know, fund managers were going to buy it, and there wasn't going to be enough physical, and the price would explode. Well, that never happened, right?
Right.
And part of the reason it never happened is because the system is set up for that not to happen. You know, you're not. What happens if, like, large asset managers all of a sudden call London and say, I want, you know, 1,000 tons of gold right now? You know, what do they get threatened? I'm sure they do. You know, so it's sort of disallowed, in a sense, from the current financial system, the way it's structured. You know, just that's how the empire runs. But once you start having geopolitical tensions, legitimate, like, nation-state superpower versus nation-state superpower kind of thing, that's where I think, you know, you can have the real run on gold. And so I think that's partly why that's an addition that's something that did not exist, let's say, from 2011 to 2018, but in my opinion will exist from 2020 to 2025. So when people ask, well, what's the difference? We had QE during that period, right? We had a debt bubble during that period. We had all these things during that period, but gold didn't do well. I think the factor that will push it over the top is not just a more pronounced failure in the global macro system, which I do think will happen in the next 5 years, but also the geopolitical battle, which I think is just getting warmed up. So that's gold, right? As far as Bitcoin, I mean, we talked about getting into the depression hole, the depression rabbit hole, after you sort of admit to yourself how things run. I have to say, I was depressed about the future of the world until I learned about Bitcoin. That was literally the turning point for me. And the reason is because once I discovered it, I said, okay, now I can see a way forward. Because up until that point, it just looked like eventual collapse and gold might do well, but society would look terrible. But when I saw that Bitcoin existed, I knew that something different could exist. I knew that people were working on the geniuses, right? The geniuses, essentially, were behind the scenes thinking very thoughtfully about a subversive way to stick it to the system, essentially. And Bitcoin is that even more than gold. And if you want to discuss that at all, we can. But yes, I do think the advent of Bitcoin is like one of the most important moments of my life, learning about it and getting into it.
Yeah, I have complex and mixed feelings about Bitcoin, and I actually have it on my list to talk with you about it, because I was one of the first fans of Bitcoin of anybody that I know. As a matter of fact, I remember sitting in my office the day that it was launched, and the reason it caught my eye is because I was in the middle of the deluge. I was in the middle of the Depression, sitting there realizing that they can just print and print and print, and they can override. You know, they can make markets not be markets again. They have nothing constraining them. And then Bitcoin was launched, and I heard an explanation of it. And I still remember, I have an uncle of mine who's like an older brother, kind of a mentor, and he ran a management firm. And I called him, and I just said, look at this. This is a shot across the bow of fiat currency. And I had no money at the time. I was just starting out, but I remember sitting there thinking to myself, this is something you throw some cash out as a lottery ticket. And I think, Mike, I mean, I get depressed talking about it, but I think it was like at $1 or $2 at that point or something like that. Now, but I will say, and my biggest reservation today, people go, oh, you're not a Bitcoiner, you're a no coiner. And I said, no. I think Bitcoin is revolutionary. I think it's one of the most democratic things I've ever seen launched. And that is precisely what scares me, because I am not, even though I detest the way that the system is currently set up, and I recognize all the things you see or that you're talking about, I also sit there through personal experience and go, you know, you might hate it. You might think these people are evil. You might think all these different things. But don't underestimate their power. And to me, you know, I look at Bitcoins. We live in a central bank dominated world. And the biggest threat that I see to central banks by far is Bitcoin. And that is precisely what concerns me. I sit there and I go, look, are these guys going to allow this? And I don't know enough, Mike. And I was looking forward to talking to you about it, because that to me is the only thing that is preventing me. And I explain to people, I go, no. It is because I think Bitcoin is so good that I'm worried about it. It's not that I'm one of those guys, oh, it's worthless. But I think it's so good and so democratic that is the real threat to its existence. How did you work through that? I know you're a very thoughtful guy. I know for a fact this isn't the first time you've heard this. How did you rationalize that, and where did you go? You know, walk me through your process of how you confronted that aspect of Bitcoin.
Okay, gosh, there's so many angles to take this from, and I'm going to try. Hopefully, I can remember a lot of them. But let's take big picture. Okay, there's two things I believe that at moments of history that we're at, you need to take account of. First of all, in the last 10 years, our lesson in this, do not underestimate the enemy, right? In other words, like the state,
yes,
or if you consider the centralized oppressive state an enemy, which I do, do not underestimate it, right? Obviously, do not underestimate the empire. The empire is willing to kill millions, maybe billions, right, to maintain control. I mean, this is a proven fact, so don't underestimate them. That's for sure. At the same time, what history also shows you is that empires always fall, that the powerful rise and the powerful fall, and hubris, arrogance, stepping forward too much are telltale signs that, you know, that power structure is going to fall. Now, you see all of that very, very present in the U.S. empire today. It's all over the place. But the other thing is this. What else causes power structures to weaken and fall? Technology.
Yeah.
Right? Some sort of asymmetric weapon that didn't exist before.
And as we warned you, we got to cut it off there due to time constraints. But you've been listening to Michael Krieger of LibertyBlitzkrieg.com. Brilliant guy, former Wall Street trader, and really been out on the front of this Bitcoin thing. And I've talked to so many of you about Bitcoin, so we wanted to have a guy on that's really got practical knowledge, that's got his money where his mouth is, early investor, early adopter. And I think you'd be wise and to listen to the rest of this interview with Mike. And you can find that at mynorthwest.com. You can also Google
Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. Takes you to the Stitcher podcast page, and you can catch the rest of that, and you can subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the most scintillating hour of radio, regardless of whether you're by your radio at 1 to 2 in the afternoons on Saturday. But anyway, we got to run. Have a wonderful weekend. Go Hawks, and we'll catch you next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.